Hello, Capital Region. Welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Up first on tonight's program, the Museum of Political Corruption's annual Nellie Bly Award has gone to New Yorker journalist Jane Mayer for her coverage of dark money in elections. HMM's Mark Dunley brings us the story. Then John Amadon of Veterans for Peace joins HMM to discuss the relationship between the wildfires in the West, climate change, and the military-industrial complex. And later on, we have episode 14 of People Science, the podcast that highlights scientists of color, featuring biology and developmental and stem cell biology PhD candidate Raymond Allen. After that, the trial of former Rensselaer County DA Joel Abelov began on Tuesday at the Rensselaer County Courthouse. We'll hear coverage of the trial from HMM's Elizabeth Press. And we'll close out with rule changes to voting in the upcoming election, now less than 50 days away. We speak to Jennifer Wilson, the Deputy Director of the League of Women Voters of New York State. But first, here are today's headlines. City documents released on Monday reveal how recently fired Rochester Police Chief LaRon Singletary and other prominent city officials did everything in their power to keep the troubling videos of Daniel Prude's deadly arrest in March out of public view. Mr. Prude's death has sparked daily protests in Rochester, as well as accusations of a cover-up. Meanwhile, six organizations, including the Buffalo branch of the NAACP, called for changes to policing in Buffalo, including opening police disciplinary hearings to the public and ending the use of school resource officers. Politico reported that Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar led an escalating pressure campaign against his own Food and Drug Administration this spring and summer, urging the agency to abandon its responsibility for ensuring the safety and accuracy of a range of coronavirus tests as the pandemic raged. Then in August, Azar overrode objections from FDA Chief Stephen Hahn and revoked the agency's ability to check the quality of tests developed by individual labs. New York had its highest rate of positive coronavirus tests in more than a month on Monday, 1%, as six states were removed from a list of travelers in those states to quarantine for 14 days upon arrival in New York. 766 new coronavirus cases across 42 counties were reported on Monday. Governor Andrew M. Cuomo has previously said that a test positivity rate of 2% or higher might raise concern. Governor Andrew Cuomo has said that he won't ban trick-or-treating statewide because of the pandemic, though it is likely that the state will offer some guidance, such as only going to your immediate neighborhood, practicing social distance, and leaving candy outside your home. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media's work, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Up first on tonight's program, on September 24th, the Museum of Political Corruption will hold a virtual event to present the annual Nellie Bly Award to New Yorker journalist Jane Mayer for, among other things, her coverage of the impact of dark money on elections. We hear from Bruce Roeder of the museum with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Bruce Roeder, who is the head of the Museum of Political Corruption. We've had Bruce on before to talk about their Nellie Bly Award, and they're going to be having a virtual event September 24th to honor this year's recipient. But Bruce, why don't we just start off with what is the Museum of Political Corruption and why in Albany?
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be on. Well, the Museum of Political Corruption is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to educating and empowering the public to improve their government. We really believe that if we're going to own the future, first we've got to own the past. So that's why we believe education is so important. We don't have a physical location yet. We do plan on having one sometime in the future. Why Albany? It's hardly that we need to ask that question. Albany has had more than its share of political corruption. It has, in fact, a rich history of political corruption, and we believe that if we can study it and learn from it, it can apply to politics anywhere in the state or in the country.
So who is your Nellie Bly Award, and maybe she award recipient for this year? And for those people who may not know, remember who Nellie Bly was, why do you call this award the Nellie Bly Award?
Well, Nellie Bly was an amazing 19th century pioneering journalist. She really helped start this entire field of investigative journalism. She's probably best known for the expose she did on the Blackwell's Island Insane Asylum in New York, where she went undercover and posed as a patient. But we were particularly inspired by her story of when she came up to Albany, because she heard there was corruption and she heard you could buy off the New York legislature to pass or kill any bill. So she put it to the test. She came here undercover, posing as a lobbyist, and in fact she was able to have a bill killed, all for the price of $1,250, and I suppose the New York State Legislature costs more these days, but that's what it was back then, and that's why we named the award after her.
And this year's recipient?
Yes, this year's recipient is Jane Mayer, the chief Washington correspondent for the New Yorker magazine. She's a fabulous choice. She's our fourth annual recipient of this award, and she herself has been a pioneer in the field. She's done tremendous work, especially with regard to the role that that dark money plays in our politics. And I encourage all of your listeners to go out and get one or more of her books, because it's really eye-opening.
Can you explain a little bit what you mean by the phrase, dark money? And is that possibly playing any role in the, 2020 elections?
I'm sure it is. It's this undercurrent where billionaires have been funding what seem to be, on the surface, innocuous think tanks of various sorts. But really, all of these groups merely are intended to serve the special interests of the wealthiest of the wealthy here in this country, particularly with regard to, say, the energy industry, the coal industry, for instance. Mayer focuses a lot on the Koch brothers, for instance, but there are other actors as well.
Mm. And I also understand you actually did have an exhibit here in the Capital District for the museum, that unfortunately was impacted by the COVID crisis?
Yes, it was. We opened up a wonderful exhibit in spring called First Responders for Democracy, where we focus on what individuals can do to improve their government. Everything from being journalists to being whistleblowers. For that exhibit, we partnered with the Albany Firefighters Museum, and it was really wonderful of them. We had a great opening. Congressman Tonko was there along with others. And then, yes, 2 weeks later, because of the COVID pandemic, we had to close down. And that's been one other reason why we have pursued an alternate route of creating a virtual museum before we go to a bricks and mortar museum.
So what will your virtual event on September 24th be like?
Well, it'll be wonderful. Jane Mayer will be there. She will be interviewed by WAMC's Joe Donahue. We actually have a bit of a surprise for her. We put together a video in tribute to her, and there are some very special people who make appearances in that video. We won't go any further now. But it will be a wonderful surprise for Jane. But I know that she wants to do a very robust question and answer period with viewers. I think she's really interested in what the public has to ask her and how she can respond to that. So we're really looking forward to this event.
And stepping back a little bit to the exhibit, did any of our esteemed, lawmakers, governor, attorney general, stop by to get some education when you had the exhibit open?
Well, that would be wonderful. I don't know that any of them did. As I said, Congressman Tonko was there. There was also a representative from the League of Women Voters was there. It was a good exhibit, and we hope it will open again right after the pandemic. And we do want to educate our leaders as well. This isn't just for the public. We want to be a resource to our state leaders as well.
You know, are there any other, you know, similar museums of political corruption elsewhere in the country, or you sort of an initial trailblazer on this?
I believe we are a trailblazer. I don't believe there's another museum quite like this in the world. As a matter of fact, Mark, I've received communication from other municipalities in the country saying, we want this museum there, say in Chicago or in some other city. And I kindly respond back that say, well, we're going to open this up in Albany first, and then we'll franchise. Because I really want Albany to be a leader in ethical governance. And that's what this museum represents. It represents a education and a new path forward.
Now, you know, you mentioned it's in Albany, and I always remember the movie Lincoln, where, you know, Lincoln's trying to twist the arms of Congress to get something done. And he tells his staff, you know, go find me 2 Albany lobbyists to take care of this. They'll know how to, you know, buy the Congress member. And certainly in the last year, you know, Shelley Silver, former Assembly Speaker, just started his visit in prison, and a number of the top Cuomo staff have been convicted in the last year or so of political corruption. Do you have any sense that, you know, is corruption getting worse or better at the state capitol in recent years?
Mark, I believe it ebbs and flows. I think it's always there under the surface. And the reason for that is just because of the amount of money that flows through New York and flows through Albany. And that type of money builds real temptation. And there is an underlying culture of power and pressure, which also leads to corruption as well. And it's nothing that is ever going to go completely away, but it's something like having a chronic illness, for instance, that is manageable, and we can manage it.
Okay. So we've been talking with Bruce Roeder about the September 24th virtual event for the Museum of Political Corruption. Bruce, you know, the webpage, how do people sign up for the virtual event?
Yes, absolutely. If you're interested in registering for this Nellie Bly Award ceremony, it's going to be a wonderful opportunity to hear Jane Mayer speak. Do visit our website, which is www.museumofpoliticalcorruption.org.
Well, thank you, Bruce. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Again, the Museum of Political Corruption's annual Nellie Bly Award will take place on September 24th, virtually honoring journalist Jane Mayer for her work and coverage of the impact of dark money on elections. Up next, we talk with John Amadon of Veterans for Peace about the wildfires out west and the relationship between climate change and militarism. John and Maureen Amand will speak about their book, Bending the Arc, this Friday at 7 at Time and Space Limited in Hudson. And this is also produced by Mark Dunley.
And we thought we'd talk to John this week about, John, have you noticed in the last few days, what is this, smoke up in the atmosphere or something?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of smoke in the atmosphere. But, you know, if I hadn't read it, I probably would have mistaken the smoke for clouds. These are from the West Coast fires. I was talking to a friend of mine in Berkeley, and she hasn't been out of her house for 22 days except for 2 very small breaks because she has asthma. And up and down the West Coast and in Berkeley, they are breathing the smoke, and it's very dangerous. Fortunately for us, we aren't.
Yeah, and of course, you know, there's a little bit of dispute with the president as to whether or not you know, these wildfires that we're seeing in California and Oregon and Washington, and we saw, you know, a few months back in Australia, is that, you know, caused by climate change or just bad weather? But how does the issue of, you know, these wildfires and climate change relate to the issue of militarization?
Well, first of all, the weather, I mean, I definitely want to address climate change because we have too many climate change deniers. The weather out west has been extremely hot and windy, and the conditions that were created by climate change were prime. The governors have been screaming out there, this is climate change. Governor Brown, back in his office, when he was back a number of years ago in office, said, you know, this is the new normal. An area larger than the state of Connecticut has just burned out there on the West Coast. And these are conditions that are a direct result of climate change. So let's stop denying climate change, climate disruption. You know, there are at least 36 dead people out there, and hundreds, if not thousands, of buildings have been burned, along with a huge, huge amount of acreage. We have to stop pretending that climate change isn't real. It's real, folks. So how does this connect with militarism? Well, it connects with a number of different ways, both directly and indirectly. For example, Newsweek and other news media news sources reported that in Oregon, six of the military helicopters that are used by the Oregon National Guard were unavailable to help fight the wildfires. Why? Because they were sent to Afghanistan and the endless wars we have going in the Middle East, but in this case, specifically Afghanistan. And these helicopters could have been used to perform water drops on the fire. But no, they're over in Afghanistan. What this actually brings us to is a really central question. Where is our national security? Who or what is killing Americans? And is the military actually doing any real good work, providing any real security or defense? You know, and you have to ask yourself, have they been helpful in stopping COVID-19? Over 200,000 Americans dead now from the disease. Or did the military help spread the disease? Have they been helpful in preventing the forest fires or in fighting them? Have they helped the Gulf Coast by stopping the invading storms? Have they prevented any of the floodwaters pouring down on the Gulf Coast, Louisiana, Mississippi, from Hurricane Sally, for example? So where is security going to come from? It certainly isn't going to come from the military because it isn't geared to help us with the types of natural disasters that we have to cope with and which in fact are killing many Americans. And then the resources that the military takes are tremendous. The estimated military budget for this coming year, October 20th or October 1st, 2020 to September 30th, 2021 is $934 billion, with more than $705 billion outlined by the Department of Defense alone. So we need to change our national priorities and begin to use the resources of our country, our taxpayer money, to care for the environment and to care for people. And, you know, back to that question mark for a minute about, you know, what are Americans worried about? Well, it depends on who you are. But for example, who is attacking Americans? Well, if you're a person of color, you're probably more worried about the police here, the occupying military forces here that are attacking you. Or if you're poor, you're worried about the virus. Or maybe you're worried about food security and housing. So all of these questions always come into play, and are important questions, and we seriously need to think about them.
Yeah, and also one thing we've seen, particularly in Oregon, was almost 500,000 people were forced to evacuate from the wildfires. And certainly there's been climate refugees before in the United States, but, you know, this is the largest in the United States. We certainly saw also climate refugees on our southern border. Certainly they were fleeing some military situations the United States helped exacerbate, like in Honduras and Guatemala, but it was also related to the tremendous drought and other problems that people see in Syria. The refugee crisis, the climate change forced people into the cities a number of years ago from the farms. And, you know, obviously Syria already had a lot of internal problems, but it just sort of was the final match that really, you know, put that situation aflame and threw Syrian refugees all across Europe. And in fact, for many years, the Pentagon has said that the greatest national security threat, it was not terrorism or Russia or China, it was climate change, because we're going to see tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of climate refugees. And, you know, the fight and the struggle over access to land and water and food. So it's just sort of really beginning to accelerate. But I also understand that you're going to be speaking on Friday, September 25th at 7 down at Time and Space Limited, along with Maureen, Time and Space Limited down in Hudson. What's that about?
Well, it certainly has to do with militarism. We're doing an outdoor book reading, socially distanced. TSL, Time and Space Limited, put up an outdoor stage, so people will all be outside in the parking lot. And we will be presenting and reading from Bending the Arc, our book, Striving for Peace and Justice in the Age of Endless War, published by SUNY Press, and it has essays by many activist authors like Kathy Kelly, Medea Benjamin, David Swanson, retired Colonel Anne Wright, Jim Merkel, an environmentalist, Jim Jennings, Conscience International, etc. This book is a book about peace activism and how folks like the ones I just mentioned and others found themselves getting involved in peace activism. So we're going to be presenting from the book and selling a few books, we hope to. And also after the showing or the reading from 7 to 8 and our presentation, there will be a showing of Dr. Strangelove, the Stanley Kubrick movie about nuclear bomb, How I Learned to Love the Bomb. And it's a terrific movie. Probably many of you have seen it.
Well, we're almost out of time. We've been talking to John Amidon. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. Just to quickly follow up, the book was also the subject of the recent Qatari press conference. You know, was that press conference, was that taped? And can people go online and listen to any of the presentations?
Yeah, the peace conference was taped. And you can look it up by going to World Beyond War. It's on their website. So Google Bending the Arc, Qatari Peace Conference, and World Beyond War. You'll pull up a World Beyond War page on their website with links to the Qatari Peace Conference.
And again, that was John Amidon of Veterans for Peace on the wildfires out west and the relationship between climate change and the military-industrial complex with HMM's Mark Dunley. The Peace Bucket is a weekly segment dedicated to the peace movement and voices from the peace movement. If you're just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, go to mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. Up next is episode 14 of People's Science, featuring Raymond Allen, a biology and developmental and stem cell biology PhD candidate at Duke University. People Science interviews researchers and scientists of color from a variety of disciplines about the importance of their work and how systems of inequity have impacted their field through a lens of social and environmental justice, especially considering the racial justice movement happening today. This is hosted by Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Aaron Blanding.
This is Aaron Blanding, and today I'm interviewing Raymond Allen for People Science, and today we're going to talk about his research and these interesting times we're living in. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Hello, hello. Hi. Hi, everyone.
All right. So I'm wondering if, just to get started, you could talk about your research and possibly what impact you hope your research has on your field.
Yeah. So as you said, I'm Ray Allen. So I'm a graduate student at Duke University. And so I came in through their developmental and stem cell biology program, and I joined their biology department. And I'm a member of the McClay Lab. And so the McClay Lab does research on early embryo development. And so we use the sea urchin as like a model organism. And we use it to study how genes interact with one another and build gene regulatory networks. And so we look at that in the context of just general early animal development and seeing similarities between it, but also some of like the biomedical impact it has. And so we are also interested in epithelial to mesenchymal cell transitions. And so that's applicable to research in cancer as well. And personally for my research, I look at how embryos recover from injury. And so early on in embryo or in the sea urchin, you can remove cell populations, and these cells are supposed to build the skeleton of the embryo. And they're the only ones that are able to do this. And when you remove them, actually, it's other cells that are never supposed to become these cells come and replace them. And my research is trying to figure out like what that genetic mechanism is behind that. And then as a minor, I am minoring in science and society. So I'm looking with an emphasis on diversity, equity, and inclusion in science. And to address the other part of your question of like what impact do I hope that my research has on my field, in the context of my bench work, I'm just kind of hoping that I will be able to contribute to the background of research that's been done on this cell reprogramming process, and hopefully can add another key component for future researchers to look into. But in the context of my minor, I'm actually very much interested on broadening the impact of like science, society, and culture on one another. And hopefully I can get scientists or sea urchin scientists to understand like why the sea urchin is important in other contexts, and to talk to the general public about like why it's important to study like the sea urchin, even beyond this like biomedical context.
That's super cool. So we've all been impacted by everything that's going on right now. And I'm just wondering, what impact have COVID-19 and the Black Lives Matter movement had on your research?
That's a good question. So early on with COVID-19, see, that happened around mid-March. So I'm hoping to finish up in the next year or so. And with the impact of COVID-19, they closed all the labs on campus. So I wasn't actually able to do a lot of this like bench research that I was talking about, which gave me all of this extra time to start digging into some of the literature that that is important for like writing my thesis, but also research that I found, or not research, readings that I found important for my minor. And so I actually was able to read a lot more books about different topics, like one talking about, it's written by Dr. Kim Talbert. It's called Native American DNA, I believe. And it talks about some of the history behind like this concept of like race and genetics and genomics that's currently talked about a lot, and especially like in the instance of tribal belonging. And so it was a book that I had like had on my shelf for a long time to read, but now with COVID I was finally able to like start digging into that and start building like my background literature so I could hopefully start citing it in my future work. And then when the Black Lives Matter movement started gaining momentum around the middle of the pandemic, it actually opened a lot of doors for me. because some of like the background work that I do is I volunteer a lot for diversity, equity, and inclusion on campus. And I felt like there was always this barrier for topics that we could talk about. So race, I think, was a very touchy subject for a lot of non-Black Indigenous people of color to talk about, to the point where I was helping organizing a book club on this book called Superior, The Return of Race Science. And I was actually beforehand like worried that like there would be backlash behind talking about this book. But now that this is happening, I think a lot of universities and or individuals are now more open to talking about this. So it's like allowing me to move forward a lot quicker.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really interesting, the shift of attention that's happening. And I'm wondering, I'm very excited by all of the, you know, conversation I see happening. And I'm wondering, what excites you most about the uprising happening today?
Well, kind of jumping off like my last point about things like making things move quicker, I feel like I've spent these past 3 years, well, I'm thinking about this in the context of like my graduate career and like the work that I've been trying to do here, is like, I feel like I've spent 3 years getting myself and other individuals to the point of like talking about some of these issues. But now that this uprising is happening, like I think things can move at a quicker pace. So one thing that I've been trying to like push for and I've read about is having like more structural changes in academia. And so actually putting like your money where your mouth is, and in the concept of departments and just universities in general to start funding some of these initiatives. And so a lot of students do a lot of this unpaid labor, especially Black Indigenous people of color are doing this unpaid labor and not reaping the benefits that maybe a faculty member that put something on their CV gets. So like within this time, we had put together like a proposal to fund a TA-ship, so a teaching assistantship for students to teach these topics of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And because of this uprising, it was moved forward pretty quickly. Like people were aware that we're trying to do this, and it was something that they could grasp onto and try and fund like right away. And there's still been like, it's been very much an uphill battle, but now my hypothesis is that like we wouldn't be where we are today if it wasn't for like the uprising happening, and this would be something that they would kick the can down the road again and again.
Well, that's really awesome. And, you know, kind of going off of what you said, talking about, you know, structural change and lasting change, what do you think is the first step in making STEM more welcoming to people of color?
I think a way to start doing that is to start early in STEM for talking about some of these issues or some of these topics to make it more inclusive. So thinking about myself when I was an undergraduate student, I very much, and some of my peers bought into this idea, like you need to be this type of person and do X, Y, and Z in order to succeed in STEM. But I think if we move beyond that narrative, and by when I say we, I specifically mean people that have more privilege or higher power in the concept of academia. So that includes graduate students, faculty, and other like senior researchers, is that they need to be having these conversations with themselves in order to change the way that they're interacting with younger students in STEM. And so younger being individuals in undergraduate, individuals in high school, and even at the elementary school level, to like start early on, because I feel like it's hard to change something just at the level that I'm at in graduate school.
Gotcha. And so I'm wondering, you know, based on your experience, what advice could you give a young person of color navigating STEM?
So my advice is to find your community. And by that, I really almost mean finding individuals that you can relate to. So I come from a tribal background, so I'm Native American. And it's something it wasn't drilled home when I was an undergrad of finding a Native community. But now that I'm like in graduate school, and I found it's harder to find people to relate to, just in like a general academic sense, because when I first got here, the only thing that students wanted to talk about was science. And at some point, like it was drilled in that like you only talk about science, and if you talk anything about else outside of science, like something's wrong. And so I very much now actively look for like finding community members or people that relate to me and building upon that and building upon it for future generations. So like this community continues to like be present. And I think one of the narratives that's talked about in science or STEM in general is like, you need to do everything by yourself. And I think that's a very like Eurocentric or very Western style of thinking of like this individualistic mentality. And if you can't do it by yourself, there's something wrong with you. And I think that's very problematic. And people need to be able to recognize the people that have helped them and the people that they're helping as well, and realize like we're all part of like different parts of a community and overlapping communities. So something that I would just recommend to individuals like in STEM in general, kind of on these topics, is to be as multidisciplinary as possible. So read literature and talk to people that are outside of your quote unquote field, because I think that will have like the biggest impact on yourself and the research that you do, and try and integrate it as much as possible and talk about it to different people, but in a way that is not filled with jargon or in a way that is, I guess, almost elitist. So be able to learn as much as you can from diverse perspectives and be able to disseminate some of that knowledge that you pick up, especially from like a decolonial mindset. So try and decolonize these concepts and like spread the word about them.
This has been Aaron Blanding, and today I spoke with Raymond Allen about his research and these interesting times we're living in for people science, and thanks for tuning in.
You can hear all of the episodes of People Science online at mediasanctuary.org. Up next, on Tuesday, opening statements began in the non-jury trial of former Rensselaer County District Attorney Joel Abelove. Abelove is charged with a felony and misconduct in his handling of the case involving Troy Police Sergeant Randall French's after French killed Edson Thevenin. In a mostly empty courtroom, Edson Thevenin's mother, Gertha DePass, sat right in the front row with Damaris Miller of Troy for Black Lives. Hudson Mohawk producer Elizabeth Press brings us reactions from Gertha DePass and Damaris Miller after they witnessed Tuesday's proceedings. The segment starts with Gertha.
I'm looking forward to the coming out right now, that the judge, everybody be held accountable for their take in my son's death. Is this not finally able to, we get to have a trial, the truth, hope, prayfully, that Nichols, is his heart is open to the truth. And from this trial, obviously we're gonna see how far up the corruption goes. Because with this trial, the cover up will reveal themselves. You know, Madden, Joe Abelove, Nichols, Tedesco, you know, we're gonna see how far up the corruption goes. Because obviously they're all friends. But with this trial right now, at the end of the trial, with the community getting together, because it's not just about Edson's death. My son is gone. I cannot have my son back. But we got to prevent this from happening to other families, to the suffering, the pain. You know, people go home and they go about their business, but we are left with the pain to deal with the ache that they left behind. But as with the community get together, it's not just Black Lives Matters, it's just the community as a whole. Our children, we gotta be comfortable when they go out. Because I have two grandkids, Edson, two kids that are being raised right now. I don't want them to be afraid to step out the door, as be afraid of their lives, that, you know, is it okay? I had them for the weekend and it's very heartbroken. They want to stay inside. I said, no, it's okay to go outside. Those are the things we're working hard for, that our children are not fearful of stepping out the door, that are afraid to get shot by the cops for whatever option they think is going to happen, the fear of our skin color. Because we're Black, okay, they're up to something. There's no reason for Edson to die. No reason whatsoever to get shot 8 times while he was in the car. They could justify it all they want. They could justify it. That's their job. But at the end of the day, there was no reason for French to shot him 8 times. The only difference with Joy Floyd and all the others, the only difference is my son's death was not videotaped. It wasn't in social media. But if it was videotaped, the way French murdered my son, if the videotape was there, it would have been the same thing. You know, now they could justify, make an excuse, he pinned him, whatever, because they're all going to testify for him. That is obvious. They've been hiding things forever. I used to live in Troy. I moved away from Troy because how bad I saw raising my youngest son. I had to move because he was being targeted. It needs to stop. Our children need to stop dying. They've got to stop targeting our black children. They need to stop targeting. I got sons. I got some more sons. I got grandsons. And I'm fearful for them. Justice needs to be done. Nichols needs to not be taking side of Abelov because they're friends. They golf together. No, Justice needs to be done. That's the whole thing that hurts, because they don't know Edson. I will continue to say it. Edson was such a sweetheart. He was the teddy bear. He was the mentor of the family. He's the go-to person that people talk to when they need help, when they need... everybody knows Edson because he was that loving man. And then for him to die by himself in the hand of Randall French like that, that's the hurtful part of it all.
My name is Damaris Miller. I'm with Troy for Black Lives, and I spent the morning in the courthouse watching the opening statements, and I'm coming out feeling really frustrated and infuriated by the defense opening statement, and hopeful that the truth will come out with these witnesses, and that the prosecutors will not let up, and that the judge who continues to flabbergast me that this judge is overseeing the case when he literally dismissed the charges, and it was only because that dismissal was appealed that the trial is now happening. I'm very concerned about him overseeing this trial, and that because it's a bench trial, he will be the only person who can hold Abelov accountable. But we already know that he is friendly to Abelov. We know that he already dismissed the charges. So it's extremely concerning to me what will be different this time around.
And when you say that you were, riled up after hearing the defense's opening statement, what stands out for you in that?
The way that he is twisting the narrative and burying the truth, like underneath so many random details and statutes and irrelevant facts, and literally twisting the truth and doing so in the name of justice.
I know I'm putting you on the spot, but do any examples come to mind in that, especially?
Yeah, one of the major issues in this case is that the ballistic evidence suggests that French was not pinned when he shot at Edson. And that was brought up by the prosecutor, and then the defense just retold the narrative as though he was pinned and pointed to, the video that happened after the shooting basically implied very strongly that French was pinned, which is just inaccurate. It's just inaccurate, and is using that to justify the decisions that Abelov made and deciding that French could never be tried, would have full immunity for this case. And just hearing again and just having to process the fact that Abelov made all these decisions within 4 days. By Thursday night, he had decided that he was not going to prosecute Abelov. How many times do people make difficult decisions in 4 days when an investigation has not even hardly begun, let alone been concluded? There's now been 3 investigations, 2 of which have concluded that the shooting was unjustified. So that he chose within 4 days to not only not prosecute French, but to actually give French immunity is really infuriating.
We were in there, we heard the 50-minute windy road around immunity, but for our audience who doesn't quite get it, what does it mean that Abelov did this waiving of immunity?
It means that Sergeant Randall French, who is the person who murdered Edson Thevenin, could never be tried, not by anyone in the district attorney's office, including not anyone at the state level, and like the attorney general, could never prosecute French for the murder of Edson Thevenin because the DA decided to give him immunity.
And the DA at the time was Abelov, who is on trial here today, and his defense attorney made the argument today that it was his power. Is that what you got out of it?
Yeah, that he just kept repeating it was his jurisdiction, even though the governor, the prosecutor had brought up the governor's statute that was specifically for cases where a civilian had been murdered or severely injured by a police officer, in which case the local law enforcement would already be compromised. And so the governor's order was created for these situations where there might be personal relationships at play. And so you need to take the jurisdiction out of the local district attorney and make sure that there's at the very least this secondary process of accountability to make sure that everything is following the law. And in this case, the DA, Abelov, removed that possibility entirely by giving French immunity and by bringing the case to the grand jury within 5 days of the shooting.
Demarest Miller, you were here. This was just the opening statements today. Will you be in the courthouse for the rest of the trial? And what do you expect to come next?
Yeah, me and other members of Toy for Black Lives will be showing up to support Edson Thevenin's family during this process to make sure that Judge Nichols knows that people are watching, that he cannot just simply dismiss the charges again like he did in 2018.
Are there any specific witnesses that you're looking forward to hearing here?
I know that the prosecution mentioned at one point that they have one witness that they feel like their case kind of hinges on. So I'm very eager to hear the testimony of that witness, because if they're central to the prosecutor's case, then hopefully they are going to provide damning evidence testimony against Joel Abelov. And what I hope to happen is I hope that the community will continue to show its support. We need to show that this case is still relevant to us, because this is still happening. And if there isn't accountability for Edson's murder, then what will happen the next time a police murders or severely injures an unarmed Black person?
And just to stick on that for 1 minute, Troy for Black Lives is out here, not only in the courthouse, but from within the courthouse, we could hear a rally outside. What is the plan for the rest of the week?
We're going to keep up the fire, keep up the pressure, keep up the sound. For me, it was it was a bit of a balm as the defense attorney was going on and on and on in his long-winded obscuration to hear the voice of our members outside calling no justice, no peace, no justice, no peace. And that we can remember that although this is happening in a courtroom and in almost entirely white officials, that there is a whole community that this impacts. There's a whole community invested in this case.
And so what are the details? When does Troy for Black Lives gather?
We will be here every morning at 9:30 a.m. outside the courthouse, Rensselaer County Courthouse. We encourage anyone who is available to come through. You can come at 9:30. Likely the court proceedings will go from around 9:30 to 12 or 1. So we encourage everyone and anyone to please come join us. Make your voice heard. Make Judge Nichols know that we are paying attention and we will not let injustice stand.
And that was HMM's Elizabeth Press reporting from the Rensselaer County Courthouse on Tuesday morning as the non-jury trial of Joel Abelov, the former Rensselaer County District Attorney, begins. You were just heard Gertha DePass, the mother of Edson Thevenin, and Demarest Miller of Troy for Black Lives. Election Day 2020 is less than 50 days away, and there have been lots of rule changes for how we vote over the past year. HMM correspondent Corinne Carey breaks it all down with Jennifer Wilson, Deputy Director of the League of Women Voters of New York State. The deadline to register to vote is October 9th, so check out these new rules and make sure you know whether you're registered and where to go and vote on or before Election Day, which is November 3rd.
Jennifer, thanks for joining me. It's been a while. I think we talked at the beginning of the pandemic when there was a rush of executive orders around voting rights, but it's been a long time.
It has, and a lot has changed since we first spoke.
Well, I'm interested in hearing about it, and I'm sure our listeners are too. We've got an election coming in about a little under 50 days now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of questions that people have about what voting is going to look like in New York come November 3rd. Tell us what you know.
Voters will actually have three ways to vote this year. So for a lot of people, this might be their first time taking advantage of early voting, which we only got early voting last year in 2019. So we'll have 9 days of early voting. We'll have our election day voting as well on November 3rd. And then also this year, we've expanded absentee voting so that any voter who wants to vote by absentee can do so by requesting an absentee ballot and marking temporary illness, which has been expanded to now include fear of COVID.
That's fantastic. Is it too late for people to register to vote at this point?
Nope, there's still a little bit of time to register. The deadline's October 9th. But the problem that we've heard a lot of people facing is that the ways to register to vote in New York State are kind of limited. So, of course, you can do a paper registration form that you would fill out and send to your county board of elections. But our online options are limited only to the DMV. So you can only register online through mydmv.ny.gov if you have a valid, up-to-date driver's license or New York State ID.
And so anyone with a driver's license can jump on the DMV website and register online.
Yes, as long as their license is up to date and it's right at the top of the page on the right side, there is a link for registering to vote.
Now, people might want to do that instead of going to get a physical application because, what, distrust of the Postal Service at this point, how long it's taking for the mail to, you know, get to its destination and come back? What are some of the reasons why you might not want to do a paper registration form?
I think the biggest barrier is probably getting your hands on a paper registration form right now. Usually the League and a lot of other voting rights groups have been out the entire summer. We've, you know, started in the fall back up again as students return to campuses, getting everyone registered that we can. And this year we've been really, really limited in doing that. And not just the League, but all groups that engage in registering voters have been extremely limited in what they can do. So getting your hands on a paper registration form may well be the hardest part of doing it via paper rather than doing it through the DMV. We are sending them out from our office. We get quite a few requests every day and we do send out those paper forms to people. But yes, I think the concern for the timing with regard to the USPS is a concern as well. But you can always drop those forms off in person at your County Board of Elections office. And you can even go into your County Board of Elections office and fill it out and hand it in person as well.
Is there anything to fear from filling out a physical registration form and mailing it in? So, for example, say you mail it in the next couple of weeks and you don't hear anything back. Can you still go to your polling place and vote?
Yes, we always tell people that if you did send in a voter registration form, whether it was through the DMV or a paper form, you can always go vote in person and do what's called either an affidavit ballot or provisional ballot. They're essentially the same things. Poll workers just call them one of those two phrases. So we always tell voters, you know, if you go to your regular polling site and you're not in the book, request an affidavit or provisional ballot, you'll be able to fill that out and then follow up after the fact to make sure that it's counted with your county board of elections. And essentially what the county board of elections does is just check and see if they have your file anywhere. They go through any voter registration forms that maybe they got in a little bit late after the deadline. And then, like we always say, make sure that you do follow up because they won't tell you if they don't count your ballot.
Well, that leads me to the question of if you're not getting anything back from the Board of Elections, you might not know where your polling site is. Can you tell our listeners how they can find out where to go and vote if they wake up on election day and think, I don't know where my polling place is?
Yeah, so the Board of Elections website, which is elections.ny.gov, has a link right at the center of the page that is for the voter lookup tool. And I think it says something like find my polling place or see if I'm registered to vote. It's all the same database of information that will tell you where you can go to vote. And they've also recently started updating it to include early voting poll sites as well. So if you use that tool over the next couple of weeks, they're adding early voting poll sites to there. So if you look on there during the early voting period, you can see what your early voting poll site options are too.
I'm going to come back to early voting in a moment, but the League also has a website where folks can check not only where their polling place is, but who's up for election.
We do, and it is going live in just a couple of days with candidates for president, congressional candidates, state senate, state assembly, judicial candidates, and we'll also have some local DA races and other local races on there as well. And our go live date is the 21st of September, and I'm very excited to be done with this project because we have over like 500 candidates on the site this year because we have so many different offices in New York State that are up for election.
For the Capital Region, is it fair to ask you what some of the hot races are?
Our district attorney race happening in Albany. Of course, the congressional races are always exciting to watch those. And Assembly and Senate seats, they're all up. I think the biggest, hottest one right now is the DA races that are happening around the state, especially because of the Black Lives Matter movement kind of putting more focus on the importance of reforming the criminal justice system. And that really does start directly with our DAs and with our judges. So that's definitely the race to watch. And usually it's kind of hard to get information about DAs and judges. So definitely check out vote411.org if you're interested in reading more about the positions of those candidates.
And you have information about candidates' positions. Now, the league is nonpartisan. How do you get information about what the positions of some of these candidates are?
We directly contact each of the candidates through email. Not every candidate responds, unfortunately, but we do try at the very least to include links to that candidate's Facebook account, their Twitter page, their campaign website. So even if the candidate doesn't respond, there is options to find more information about them. But it's completely up to the candidate whether or not they're going to participate. But yes, everything comes straight from the candidate's mouths.
So back to early voting. Last year was the first year that we had early voting in New York. And I know that for me, I live in Rensselaer County. I live in Lansingburg. And there was a lot of controversy over the fact that there were few early voting sites and they were pretty far away from downtown Troy. What can you tell us about improvements that have been made to early voting sites this time around?
So there will be a Troy site this year, which we're very pleased about because, yes, we were very dismayed that there was no site in Troy last year, but there is one this year. But some counties have added more sites. Something exciting that happened in Albany County was that now any voter can go to any early voting site, whereas last year in 2019, the sites were assigned for early voting. So you had to know your election district and ward, and it was just very confusing. So now in Albany, you can go to any site. Also, some of the sites have changed because they had to follow the new COVID protocols to have a certain amount of space between the machines and a certain amount of space within the facility itself so that they could accommodate enough people while they were having early voting but still have social distancing. So make sure that you do check your early voting site before that you decide to go and vote early. If you do want to vote by absentee ballot, make sure you do get your request in now. The state just created an online portal, so any New York State voter, regardless of your county, can apply for an absentee ballot online. And that website is absenteeballot.elections, as in multiple elections, .ny.gov, and it's super easy. It takes less than 2 minutes to apply for your absentee ballot. You can also say if you want it sent to another address. That's like the second question they ask is, where do you want this ballot sent? And those ballots are going to be going out pretty soon. Definitely get your request in now so that you can get your ballot as early as possible and get it back as quick as possible. And also remember, if you don't want to put it in the mail, if you're worried about mailing it back, you can drop it off at any early voting or election day poll site, and one of the governor's new executive orders mandates that there be a special line for people who are just going in to drop off their ballot. So you're not going to have to wait in the main line. You'll be able to just walk right up, drop off your ballot either in some sort of box or bag, and know that your ballot is going to be counted and be secure.
If I apply for an absentee ballot and then I change my mind and I actually want to go and vote in person, because that's always exciting, can I not?
Yes, New York State is one of the few states that allows voters to do that. And in New York State, we have a really thorough procedure of vetting all of the absentee ballots to make sure people didn't vote twice. And what the county boards of elections essentially do is that at the end of the election, they compare the absentee ballots they have to the signatures in the poll book to make sure that no one didn't vote in person and vote by absentee ballot. And if you did vote in person, they just invalidate your absentee ballot and count your in-person ballot.
Again, that was Jennifer Wilson, the Deputy Director of the League of Women Voters of New York State, with HMM correspondent Corinne Carey. Election Day 2020 is less than 50 days away. The deadline to register to vote is October 9th, so make sure you know whether you're registered and where to go and vote on or before Election Day, November 3rd. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news at 6 p.m., 7 a.m., and 9 a.m. And you can also find all the segments you heard on today's show online at mediasanctuary.org and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. To send us a comment, suggestion, or just, you know, tell us how we're doing with our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget, this program is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in producing with us, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. And until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.